Sometimes the preacher preaches a message to the congregation. That is, he comes with a specific word that God has laid on his heart to say to the congregation, or maybe he just wants to chew them out, I don't know. But sometimes the pastor, the preacher, does or should do something different. And so I'm going to tell you today that today I'm largely going to be talking to myself for the next half hour. I invite you to listen if you would like. You may walk away with a worse impression of me, but perhaps something I say will resonate with some of your thoughts and experience. In theory, today I was going to preach a psalm that helps us express sorrow or lament in prayer. The idea was that the sermon would coincide with the sermons on sadness, both good and bad, that I preached a month or so ago. A couple weeks ago, I preached a psalm that had some anger in it and was looking at the psalm as a biblically given way for us to express anger, perhaps, in prayer. So I was going to do that today, that was the theory, to do that today about sorrow. And there's really no shortage of material. I read Psalm 77, one of the lament psalms, and these so-called lament psalms are numerous. And they can be found through virtually all parts of the book of Psalms. But I ran into a problem as I started to work on that. I looked at many of the lament psalms. I've been reading psalms a lot in recent days. And the problem I ran into was that I kind of struggled to identify with them. Maybe you've had that experience when you've read the psalm. You read a psalm and you look at it and you think, man, this guy sounds like a drama queen. This guy sounds like he needs psychiatric treatment. Right? He needs some counseling or some Prozac or something. The passion and the pathos of some of these psalms is honestly, if you really look at it, is unsettling. The various psalmists freely express profound emotions and profound distress. Even that psalm I read just a couple minutes ago from Psalm 77. When was the last time in your prayer you said the words, "Has God's steadfast love ended forever?" I don't pray like that. I suspect you don't. And you think it's because you're too good of a Christian to pray that way. Possibly. These psalmists cry out to God in strident tones. They accuse. They cry. They mourn. They weep. They beseech. Now, I complain plenty. Ask my wife. I whine plenty. I get plenty irritated too. Sometimes I just downright wallow in self-pity. But it seems to me that the psalmists are up to something different than that. First of all, most of the time when I do my whining, I do it not to God or at God, maybe not even near God, but usually lashing out at the people nearest me. The psalmist's intensity is caught up in psalms that have a God-directedness in their complaint. It seems to take them to a very different level than my complaining, my whining. And so I got to thinking about, why is it that these psalms seem so foreign to me? Why don't I identify with the lament psalms? It raises the question, do these psalms still speak to us? Can they speak to us? If they do speak to us, are we hearing them rightly? And if they don't seem to speak to us, why not? Is that a problem with the psalm? Is it a problem with me? It's supposed to be tempting to sort of chalk it up to cultural differences. We might say to ourselves, well, those old Hebrew poets, they just wore their emotions on their sleeves. I mean, that's poets for you, isn't it? And we're people of the stiff upper lip. We've been trained by our genetics, probably, and certainly by our culture, to be reticent with our emotions. Unless, of course, the emotion is anger. Often we give free rein to that. or perhaps if your sports team has scored a goal. Today I want to look at Psalm 13. So I invite you to turn there. Psalm 13. It's probably one of the most well-known lament psalms. Scholars regard it as kind of a stereotypical personal lament, has all the pieces. It's also a rather short one, and it's early in the Psalter. And while I'll comment on a couple of things that the psalm itself says, I'm actually more interested today in using this psalm and its passion to challenge me, to critique me. Why does this way of prayer unsettle me? Why does it not connect with me? And I think it's an important question to try to answer before I can really expect to start using these sorts of psalms in my prayer life. My goal this summer was to preach psalms as models for our prayer life. But when I look at many of these lament psalms, there's just a disconnect. How can I begin to think I could fruitfully use these in my prayer life when I read the psalm, it just doesn't connect? So today I want to suggest, I'm going to ask myself maybe three reasons why I struggle with this psalm or these psalms, to answer the question, what's my problem with these prayers? Let's start in Psalm 13. Let's look at the first couple of verses. How long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long must I take counsel in my soul and have sorrow in my heart all day? How long shall my enemy be exalted over me? I read these verses and the plaintive tone is so obvious from the very first words, and it makes me wonder, Maybe it's the passion of these psalms that is so unsettling to me. Maybe it's the passion that explains why I don't connect with them. You can imagine the words, "How long, O Lord," being uttered in a variety of tones, probably. For just a moment, imagine the psalmist on his knees praying this psalm. What does his voice sound like when he says, "How long?" This is not the voice of your 7-year-old from the back seat asking how long before you get to the amusement park, probably. Although after a while it might start to sound this way, I'm not sure. You can probably imagine it in a couple of different voices, but all of them are emotional, aren't they? Maybe a wail, a groan, a sigh, a strangled whisper. If I go no further than just these first few words of the psalm already sort of stands in rebuke of me and my tepid, emotionless prayer life. When do I cry out this way? Why don't I? It's supposed to be bad enough if this psalm, Psalm 13, was the only psalm sort of expressed in this key. But then I read a little further and discover that, believe it or not, the psalms of lament and sorrow in the book of Psalms outnumber the happy psalms. There is more sorrow and lament in the book of Psalms than there is praise and thanks. So now not only is there one psalm that sort of critiques me with its powerful emotions, and as I look at it and it makes me unsettled, but then I realize, for the psalmist at least, whatever their condition was in, they were in, and as the people put together the book of Psalms, they selected more sorrowful, lamenting, emotionally powerful psalms to give as a prayer book to God's people than they did psalms of praise and victory and thanksgiving. So now, I not only don't pray very emotionally, but I don't pray emotionally nearly enough, apparently. It's as though, as I read these verses, it's as though the psalmist is speaking an emotional language that I don't even understand. In his book, The Shallows, What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, Nicholas Carr admits the change over the space of a few years that he noticed in his ability to focus deeply. And he traces the cause to the way that content is presented to us on the internet and suggests that the way that's presented, it invites shallowness. It invites skimming, doesn't it? There's always another thing to click to. There's always another link. There's always another story. I mean, it's really gotten bad lately. You'll have the story and there's links within the story itself. And if you do have a Kindle, now there's things in the text of your books where you can just, you know, click and be taken to a web page somewhere. It invites us to skim rapidly from one bit of content to the next. His observation is probably correct. My point today is not to abuse the internet. But I kind of wondered this week if the internet has just sort of extended or completed a change that the pace of modern life started long ago for us. And that is the inability to really enter into moments in life deeply. Do we, can we anymore, really enter into life's moments meaningfully? Part of this is just the pace of modern life. There's always something else to do. There isn't time to stop and process. There isn't time to stop and emote. And so much like our brains sort of skip along the surface of the internet as we click from thing to thing, or as you sit there with your television clicker and go from program to program, I think emotionally we skip across the surface of life. Never really, or very rarely, entering into life's moments and the emotion and the power there. And I suppose the internet sort of is part of this. Think about how easy it is to read some sad post on Facebook about some friend of yours that's struggling with cancer, and then you scroll down and the very next thing you see on Facebook is some goofy video. How do you enter meaningfully into the pain and emotion of your friend that's going through cancer when the very next click you make takes you to, you know, videos of the 10 stupidest people in America? And I think that's just emblematic, okay? I'm not bashing Facebook. But it's emblematic of this world in which we live does not set us up to truly enter into life's moments. There's always something else to do. There's some other life link to click, whether it's literally a link on the computer or if it's just moving on to the next thing. Lament, like we see the psalmist entering into so powerfully and so emotionally here in Psalm 13, requires that we enter into our situations and examine them and examine our emotions in them. And I think that I may just live a life too shallow for true lament. The psalmist dives deep into the pain and the difficulty and the emotion of his life. I seek and my whole world around me sets me up to skip from one thing to the next without ever truly diving into them. We dip into emotions here and there, but so often I don't enter into them. We say words to others, but so often we avoid sharing deep feelings, probably often because we're afraid of them. Some of you may answer that the problem for you is just sheer emotional overload. There's just too much to respond to. And that can be true too. Whether it's exposure to the unrelenting, tragic news of the media cycle, or maybe the equally unrelenting exposure to the hard lives of the people you minister to, our lives, our ministry lives, our daily lives can overwhelm our senses. I just can't enter into it all, Stephen. And you're probably right, you can't. But not emotionally entering into anything at all just can't be an acceptable human response to those realities. Never mind a Christian response. In any event, I wonder for myself if the psalmist's passion does not fully compute for me because I am emotionally stunted by my own choices, by the world in which I live, by my own fear of entering into sorrows, mine or the sorrows of others, at the level that the lament psalm enters into. Maybe it's the passion. Let's look at a couple of other verses, though. It's verses 3 and 4. This is the psalmist's plea. Consider and answer me, O Lord my God. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Lest my enemies say, I have prevailed over him. Lest my foes rejoice because I am shaken. As I read a little further in the psalm, I wonder if it's not only the passion he displays that I don't connect with, that unsettles me, that makes these psalms difficult to relate to. I think I may also struggle to identify with these psalms because I don't connect with the psalmist's sense of having enemies. You ever had that feeling when you read these psalms and the psalmist is going on about his enemies? You're like, dude, he had a tough life, man. What was he doing? He had so many enemies. Like, you know, he's getting bullied at school or what? I mean, he's just going on about the enemies. And you say to yourself, do I have enemies? Gee. I mean, Bill down in accounting doesn't like me much, but you know, I wouldn't call him an enemy, right? People in the house next door on the ranch, you know, we don't always see eye to eye, but we haven't come to blows yet, so, you know, wouldn't call them my enemy. Maybe we think, maybe he's speaking in hyperbole. But here and in other psalms, and I could give you numerous ones, he seems to cast the problem in the starkest possible language. You see this? It's a matter of life and death. Verse 2, how long shall my enemy be exalted over me? Will my enemy win permanently, God? Verse 3, he seems to warn God that the only likely outcome, unless God intervenes, is his own death. Light up my eyes, lest I sleep the sleep of death. Do something, God, or I'm dead meat, in the vernacular. Here, in another of the lament psalms, the psalmist is often vague about the nature of the enemies. Some are more specific, but talk about actual physical enemies or health problems. Sometimes it appears that the enemies are bringing some sort of a spiritual attack. Often, though, the psalms are just kind of vague about what kind of enemies these are. But in any case, it always seems so vivid and clear for the psalmist. He knows what the enemies are. He feels oppressed by them, and he's calling upon God to intervene. Faced with the psalmist's strong statement of his problems, many of us, at least I am, are kind of sheepish about our own situations, right? Dude, that guy had like people surrounding him like strong bulls of Bashan, whatever that means. And I just got, you know, kind of crabby Bill in accounting. I don't have enemies. How can I pray a prayer like this when I have enemies? I mean, I can't pray, how long, O Lord, will I suffer with this canker sore? That doesn't seem right, right? Come on. We look around and we don't really see ourselves as having these sorts of enemies pressing us. And maybe we don't. I don't think the psalmist had this every moment of his life. I sometimes find myself wondering if I lack this sense or experience of enemies because I'm not doing anything worth opposing. You ever ask yourself that question? Maybe I don't have any real spiritual enemies because I ain't doing anything that threatens the enemy. Jenks? Nah. Don't worry about him. He ain't going to cause us any trouble. Copa America's on this week. He ain't doing nothing. If we're honest, though, and this is, again, the problem, we don't want to be honest with our emotions, first part of the sermon. I don't know that we really want to be honest about our enemies sometimes. I have many enemies. though they often attack from within rather than from without. Their fears, weaknesses, struggles, and inabilities that I have that plague me. That when I'm honest about it, I see that they limit my effectiveness as a husband, as a father, and as a minister. And they attack me regularly. And in my darker and more honest moments, I see them and acknowledge them. There's subtle views and values of the world that quietly run counter to the gospel, but that I embrace and that derail me, often without me even realizing it. There are passions to which I'm still altogether too enslaved. There's indifference, judgmentalism, greed, and pride that influence my behavior far too often. And in my more spiritually lucid moments, I do call upon God to enlist His help in waging war against these enemies within. Far more often, though, I'm altogether too comfortable with these enemies. I don't see them as the imminent threat of death that the psalmist sees his enemies to be. And let's be honest, all of our enemies, internal and external, are just species of death. And so maybe it's this comfortability with my enemies that causes me not to pray as the psalmist prays. I just don't take my enemies and God's enemies seriously enough to cry out this way. Or maybe I know that if I really start to pray this way, I will have to get serious about my enemies. And some of them are just all too dear to me. So maybe it's his passion, or maybe it's this issue of the enemies that is why I don't pray this way. And if you thought the sermon was uncomfortable so far, let me add some frosting. Sour frosting. Because I think at the end of the psalm it gets worse for me. Verses 5 and 6. But I have trusted in your steadfast love. My heart shall rejoice in your salvation. I will sing to the Lord because he has dealt bountifully with me. This is the psalmist's recognition of God's character and God's answer to his plea, or God's faithfulness to answer someday. And I wonder that maybe I don't lament and pray this way because I don't like the answer that I think I might get if I pray this way. Is it the answer that God brings to these prayers that keeps me uncomfortable? Verse 5, the psalmist says that he trusts in God's steadfast love. But I'm kind of like Jonah, in that I suspect that God's version of steadfast love may not involve the dramatic, enemy-crushing outcome that I prefer. You know, Jonah preaches very reluctantly and then goes and sits outside the city, crosses his arms and says, "May the fire fall down from heaven." And then gets ticked off when it doesn't. And when God engages him in conversation, Jonah looks at him and says, "I knew you were going to do this. You were going to be forgiving and unrelenting because of your steadfast love. I knew it. You always do that." You see, I know about God's radical answers to humanity's prayers and questions. If your eye offends you, read this book and get an accountability group. No. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. Forgive your brother 70 times 7. Take up your cross and follow me. I know about this God. His version of steadfast love and his solution to the problem was, I'll send my son to die. And then invite me to share in that death, take up my cross and follow him. I don't know that I trust God's steadfast love to turn out the way I want it to. And so, not liking God's answers, or at least not being confident that I will like his solutions, instead of praying this way, I try to find some other way to deal with my problems. What do we do? Well, one response is that we do our best to ignore or flee circumstances that might drive us to this type of prayer. When the going gets tough, the tough get going. That sounds positive, but often it just means when the going gets tough, we take off. We do what we can to change our circumstances rather than face it and pray through it with lament. Leave this job, end this marriage, medicate with entertainment, distract myself, rather than submit my situation in lament and prayer. Lord, this job, this ministry, this marriage is not what I signed up for. How long, O Lord? But that's too hard to pray. So I quit, or I emotionally disengage. Another popular response is to work instead of pray. We don't think lamenting will help anything, so we don't bother. What good is it going to do if I get on my face before the Lord and whine and cry about my situation? That never solves anything, right? Things aren't going well, we'll put in more hours. We'll look for a solution. We'll read another book. We'll try another technique that someone has claimed has worked for them. What good would whining to God do about it, right? We're practical people. We're people of action. So we work instead of pray. Honestly, working, doing something, is almost always preferable to me to this sort of praying anyway. Not only am I unsure that I will like God's answers, but at this really fundamental level, I don't really like at all that my situation has brought me to the place where I have to call on God in the first place. To pray the way the psalmist prays involves an acknowledgement that only God can truly help. This is to acknowledge my weakness, my frailty, my inability. And I don't know about you, but this I am loath to do. True lament like that the psalmist does can only exist in a drama where God is understood to be the sole true actor. To pray in this way is to acknowledge that I have reached the end of my resources and that all that is left is for God to act. Sustained lament, like the psalmist does here, acknowledges my complete inability to manage life and my own emotional responses on my own. And so, I neither want to admit that, nor am I confident of what God will do if I admit it and open it up for Him to do as He does. So I think my problems with these sorts of prayers are these three things, at least. I have a problem with the passion because I just don't know that I'm entering deeply enough into my life and my circumstances to pray this way. I'm not sure I want to face up to my emotions of hopelessness or anger or fear. I think I have a problem with how clearly he sees his enemies as enemies that threaten him and his spiritual health. And I don't want to admit that my enemies are truly enemies because I like them too much. And most fundamentally, I think I have a problem with the answer. Because the answer in Psalms that God most often gives to lament is not really a solution. It's himself. It's his presence. And that's not what I want most of the time. I want rescue. I want vindication. I want restoration of my peace and my health and my comfort. I want to call the fire from heaven down on the taxi cab driver. Or my child. Or the congregation. Or the government. There'd be a lot of scorched earth if I got my way. I suspect yours too. Friends, the Psalms don't just model prayer and emotion for us. As God's gift to us, they may actually present us first with a critique of where we are at emotionally, where we are at in our prayer intensity, where we are at in our assessment of our problems. But they also may present us with new vistas, new directions and emotion and emotional expression that are not natural to us, but that we should seek to learn in order to be spiritually healthy and fully human. What do you have that needs to be lamented? It may be 30, 40 years old, and you never lamented it. And yet, the right human response to it would be to lament and mourn before God for that abuse in your past, for that infidelity, for that failure, for that waste of God's grace in your life. There are things that we have that are worth lamenting, but to lament them, we must enter into them emotionally. We don't want to do that because it's scary territory. But the Psalms present, invite, push us towards entering into our lives that way. If I don't pray this way ever, if we don't pray this way, why not? I suspect that none of the answers to that are good. Why we can't pray this way. The disciples asked Jesus a simple thing. Lord, teach us to pray. I want to ask the Lord at this time to do the same thing. Let's pray together. Lord, teach us to lament. Teach us to care passionately enough about things, about you and your will and your way in this world, about your people, about their suffering, about evil, that we can pray earnestly for them, whether crying out, how long, O Lord, or crying out, your will be done. Teach us to care. Teach us to enter in emotionally to the realities of life, not to skip across the surface of life, with every touch hardening our hearts against the deep emotional realities at work. Teach us to take our enemies, your enemies, spiritual and physical, more seriously. Teach us to see ourselves engaged in a battle of life and death. Teach me. Teach us to reckon with you, to submit ourselves to you and your steadfast love, not holding back because I fear that your answers will demand more of me than I can bear, or that your answers might not come in the timing that I want, or that your answers may involve yet even more suffering, so that I might learn to press even more deeply into the truth of who you are. Teach us to reckon with you, your steadfast love and your sovereignty. Lord, teach us to pray. Teach us to pray. Teach us to pray. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.